section of the, shall we call it the working model of marriage?
Mm-hmm. Let's call it child-centered.
Okay, the child-centered marriage leads to the destruction of, among other things, our religious institutions.
It undermines it.
Undermines it. Do you think that it might also be argued in the opposite, that as our religious faith in our, in general, in our population has been dropped, the preservation of the family, as most religions teach it, has been thrown out of the water? In other words, I almost got from your talk that one is the cause of the other.
Excellent.
I think it's a more or less
That is a wonderful point, and I think an important corrective. We don't, it's difficult in such matters to speak of cause and effect when you have mutually symbiotic relationships. You're right. We don't really know so far if it's the decline of religiosity that is primarily responsible for the erosion of marriage or vice versa. But we do know that once it starts declining, that that mutually symbiotic relationship tends to go into a downward spiral. So you're right. It's not simply cause and effect one way. Thank you very much. Any other questions? I was told you were a talkative crowd. Yes, go ahead.
I don't want to.
That's okay.
The other thing that I'm really wondering about is the wisdom of teaching your children that they are the center of the world. You know, you're arguing that we're throwing them away. We're saying adult pleasure supersedes the well-being of the children. And I've heard that argument before, and I accept it. But if we as parents tell our children that we're ready to sacrifice anything and everything for their well-being, does that not also generate a certain self-centeredness in them? Except, hopefully, that they will, having watched their parents sacrifice for their children, will then subsequently sacrifice for their own. I think that's the positive side of it. But I don't know, from a religious point of view, and from a faith point of view, I really believe that the most solid marriage, and I've observed it in my parents, my wife's parents, etc., is that which is strongly faith-based, and the center of the marriage is the faith in God. And then the children will pick that up too, that, you know, my parents are sacrificing not only for me, but also for others, and they have this profound belief and faith, and that they pattern their lives after that, and that gives our whole society a great deal more stability than any of the above.
That's an excellent point, and it goes to the idea, what is the foundation of your normative, moral, or ethical universe? If you are the foundation of your moral and ethical universe, if man is in fact the measure of all things, then it really is either a pleasure-pain calculus, as long as it feels good, do it. Or it means there's just no rules at all. Whatever you feel is right. So insofar as faith accepts some kind of objective morality, something that's not simply a question of me and my desires, it does tend to provide a firmer foundation for family life, I would say even for ethical reasoning generally. I mean, many people will purport that you cannot raise religious arguments. And in some respects, what they're saying is true. There are some people, as soon as they hear God, they're going to shut you down. They're not going to listen to you. It's just religious. But I think that those who are people of faith would do well to explore the foundations, the ethical foundations of those who purport to be purely secular. Because you're going to find out it's a very weak foundation. Why do you believe in equality? If you don't have a good answer for that question, it means that that norm can become just about anything. It depends on who's in power. Any other questions?
Somebody else say something profound. Come on.
I've come from Florida. Somebody must have a question. Go ahead.
Well, maybe it's an observation. I don't know. Being you're from the U.S., we, of course, are going to have some discussion of this on probably a vote in the fall in Parliament here, it looks like, according to recent newspaper accounts. But apart from, given the changes, given the slide, and I appreciate very much the arguments you put forward, giving us a framework to carry that debate forward. But given the changes have already taken place, apart from the people of faith engaging in a very significant way, and apart from a very significant, almost what some people would want to call a mirror, for learning this back, point of order, religious language, is there really any hope in a secular sense of turning this tide back?
That I do not know. I don't know if it's at a point now where it is truly a tragedy, in the sense that it's now irrevocable, in the sense that you've now made a decision in which it is likely that a set of harms is going to occur that you cannot change the tide for. I cannot answer that question. That's up to the Canadian people. Yes.
You made a great point in terms of can we turn the tide, but what is Mr. Bush going to do? He's President Bush is apparently engaging himself in the debate again, once again. And even within the Christian community or the church community or the faith community, rather than the church or otherwise, it's very difficult to find unanimity in thought in terms of their vision, because the church has also been caught up in this whole issue of equality of rights. And those who you might otherwise think would not engage in that kind of thinking are thinking that way. So it really makes it difficult for the politicians who've taken up this matter and have gone forward with it, because even the churches haven't been supportive of the members of the parliament or the politicians.
Well, that's a very good point, but I would also like to note that sometimes what also happens within churches is that you have a dissenting sect which says, well, I am speaking for the church, that opposes it. And then in the public eye, well, you know, even Roman Catholics are divided, so it's really not something that they believe in. That's dishonest. But it is the kind of characterization that is prevalent within the media. I think part of the problem with this debate among people is that in some respects we've just got lazy in our thinking about rights. Now, if you want to frame it as rights, frame it as a child has a right to a mother and a father, to his mother, her mother and father.
I'll say people who make those arguments would argue that a number one child has no rights.
Well, that unborn child in this case, because it's not the abortion debate, we're going to bracket that. In this case, we have a child who we know is going to have a mother and a father. A child cannot come into the world without a mother and a father biologically. Cloning is possible. Indeed, there's going to be great demand, I would think, over time, especially if the norms underlying companionate marriage, where it's all about me. No, well, why shouldn't I be able to have somebody who I'm related to without this messy business of somebody else who I'm probably not going to stay with very long? Why can't I just clone myself? You know, that sort of asexual reproduction is going to look pretty attractive. And then there's really is a sense in which I can live forever, because it is all about me. Yes, it's a grave risk. Go ahead.
I think it's important to introduce a lot more of the social science aspect into the debate, because I think in many respects, those of us on this side of the debate have marginalized ourselves by basically saying, we're not going to debate the issue whether it's discriminatory. We just want to have the right to discriminate because we're religious. It makes us feel bad.
You
so
can't.
Having some of this social science is important. You're talking about some of the logical arguments. My employer is on the Environment Committee. And one of the things we're debating right now is a precautionary principle. And you pointed out, and I looked at the research myself, there's a real dearth of research on the implications of same-sex marriage on children. Nevertheless, you can still draw into the whole concept of companion marriage. But I mean, it's just that lack of logic that, yes, on environmental issues, we're going to use a so-called precautionary approach. But we're going to throw a the idea of a precautionary principle completely out the window when it comes to implications of changing marriage on children, and just continue to drive home the lack of logic and the...
Excellent. I think that the point that you're making is a very important one. You're right. There is a dearth of evidence in terms of how children fare in same-sex households. And it would just take a generation for that to be produced. We just don't have it at this point in time. But note that it is not because we're assuming that gays and lesbians are necessarily going to make bad parents. We have no evidence one way or another in terms of what they are as people are going to be like as parents. In that sense, it's just a social experiment. But what we are doing is that we are undermining the norm that it's mother, father, child. We are destabilizing the institution because it's normative. And so, however, you can get the best lesbian couple in the world. They're just, bang up parents in so many respects. But the cost of that is the normative institution. It's the expectation for everybody else that you're supposed to gear your sex life into the institution of marriage, and you're supposed to be mother and father and raise that child. That is the message that comes out of it. Is that it's okay to sever that bond. And indeed, it has to be severed for them to be parents. Yes?
I don't have a question, but I think I just wanted to comment.
Sure.
In response to what you have said. What I have observed and what I like about your presentation is the fact that you have discussed the issue on several fronts. You have dealt with the moral issue of self-centeredness. You've also dealt with the importance of the mother-father-child relationship. You have dealt with possible social implications, which I think this gentleman pointed out. You also made reference to the economic backlash that society can face. And it seems to me that this is the kind of approach that needs to be taken in the debate. Because people come at their lives, they understand their lives and their needs. Some economically, some morally, some religiously. And so if we can bring to the fore the effects that this kind of legislation can have on the various aspects of society, I think it might be able to get people to be more attentive to what we are seeing, rather than simply dealing with the issue of two people loving each other.
I think that there's much wisdom to what you are saying. And part of the reason that I believe it is not discussed more in these terms is that when we think of politics, and this is symptomatic, I think, of the emphasis that we give to the state itself, we think about the state and the individual. We don't think about the other intermediate organizations. So if you read political treatises, most political scientists, most political theorists have not studied the family, have not thought through the importance. It's just always been a given. It's always there. It's always foundational. I mean, Aristotle mentions it and then goes on. Rawls makes some passing references, to the family. Of course, it's essential. But to really focus on it and its relationship to other institutions of society so that if you dismantle it, the sort of effects that it has, I think you're right, I think it's something that deserves greater exploration so that we don't speak in sloppy terms about, oh, it's foundational. We pay lip service to this idea, but, it's foundational, but it's just about love. So it's really not that important. Any other questions? Yes, go ahead.
Or maybe if there's no one else.
That's okay, yeah.
Just an observation that some of these people here may find interesting. When we went through this whole thing, I recalled back over the years, even before I was in politics, I had a number of friends who went after finding out their biological parents. Back in my day, before contraception and divorces, unwanted children were put up for adoption and were then raised by two people not biologically connected to them. There were quite a few of them. And I remember one particular interview that I had with the guy, and this was after I was an MP. He wanted help to find his biological mom and dad. And I said, but you keep telling me that your parents that raised you were ideal parents, you had a wonderful loving home, why do you want to know this? And he said to me, Ken, I don't know. It's just I have this need. I want to know who my mom and dad are. And eventually he did find his parents. But it was an overwhelming desire. And I think it's something that's perhaps innate in us. And I observed that as a way of connecting the need, the right of an individual to know their biological roots.
Well, I don't know if it's innate or not, but you're right that it's a very strong need that comes from thinking people. You want to know what your roots are. You know, it's not like there was a magic wand, poof, I came from nowhere. Now, what is the history? What has preceded me? Because that, in part, defines who you are. And this is in part why the United Nations itself is not endorsing same-sex marriage, because it understands a child has a right to the mother and father. It's not really a gay and lesbian issue at all. Any other questions? That is when Margaret Sanger, who is the founder of Planned Parenthood, began her greatest activity. That's right. Now, if Planned Parenthood itself began in the 1920s, I'd have to look it up, but she's the founder, and the arguments that she was making were in the 1920s. And there is a large history, largely progressive history, tracing her contribution in the progressive movement. If you're interested in it, you can always tap into it. Yes?
I was just thinking how heterosexuals, I think, should acknowledge that they were kind of the roots of this change to preventing marriage, and that they were the ones that decided that, you know, something that was self-fulfilling and emotionally satisfying was more important than children. So is there, and non-Christians and Christians alike, in the same reverse the same divorce rate. So is there a call for heterosexuals to mobilize and be better parents or stronger parents?
Well, I think there is, because you're right. We could only get to this point in which there is a serious debate about gays and lesbians marrying, because heterosexuals have acted according to a principle of antinomian hedonism themselves for a generation. And then, of course, it's just, well, we want to, you know, why, me too. And then, of course, it's discrimination if you don't let me do it too. So in many respects, it is a heterosexual issue. It's an issue of, are heterosexuals taking responsibility for their children? Are they taking responsibility for their sexuality? Are they taking responsibility for the implications that, yes, you may very well be a dad. You may very well be a mom. You are going to have responsibilities. They are going to be responsibilities that are unlike anything else you've ever seen in your life, because that's a job that never ends. That's 24/7. But yes, I think you're right. I think we could only get to the point where this becomes a real issue because heterosexuals have to some extent, for their own purposes, started dismantling marriage. Any other questions? Yes.
From behind. Yes. The voice. in terms of the horses out of the barn argument, and going back to your normative, you had 4 points of what is or isn't normative. And the first point had to do with sex inside marriage, sex before marriage, sex before, after, during, whatever. And it seems to me that that norm is pretty well gone out the window.
It does, yes.
And so one out of your four is about male.
May I just interject, except insofar as there might be a revitalization of institutions of civil society, because I don't think that the state at this point can revisit. I don't think that it's, that's why I think it's a tragedy.
It's a bit of a complex, and you're right to say that the state of the institutions of family and marriage will
and religion
necessarily decline, and the state will replace that back. Having said that, that's one of the four norms, if you will, is really gone. And the second norm that I think is really gone is the long-term commitment. I don't know if people do this statistically or not, but I suspect that if you take a whole spectrum of all the marriages that happen in June, which would be a favorite time, that people sort of see it as, a lot of people see it as simply a commitment, but as long as it's working, we'll stay together, and if it's not working, then we won't stay together. So half the ball game is pretty well done before you ever get to the horses out of the barn argument. And so heterosexuals having essentially destroyed marriage, with their trivialization of the institution, it therefore becomes no great surprise that you move from a child-centered view of marriage to a couple-centered view of marriage.
That's exactly right.
So, while we might want to beat our chests about the invidious nature of homosexual lobbying, et cetera, 98% of the whole thing is already over with because of the activities. Heterosexual. So the horse is out of the barn, not so much because of the homosexual laws. The horse is out of the barn because of
heterosexual. Exactly. I agree. And then the question is, can you turn the tide? I don't know if it can be or not. I mean, the one thing that I do know is that we still make choices from where we are. I mean, it's not completely over yet. And we have very good reason to believe that if it's not turned around, things are going to get a whole lot worse still. I mean, what it means, the big picture is a society in decline, a civilization in decline.
Market arguments as well, that ultimately it is a society decline, ultimately you replace, the demographic shift is such that A, you're not going to have the bodies, and B, you're not going to have the attitude to look after the most vulnerable.
That's right. And I'm not, of course, the first one to make this argument. Many realists within the realm of international relations, looking at hard indicia of power, make the argument that the West essentially is now in its golden days. That the 20th century, in some ways, was as good as it gets. If anything, indicia of power, the West has slipped in terms of its power since the highlight of it was probably just before World War I. And then Europe did itself in with two world wars, which made America come to the fore de facto, because it was the power that was left. But that the West thereafter, in terms of hard power, has been declining with reproduction, with territorial holdings, with the extent to which it's responsible for economic output and technology and such. Now, in some respects, there are some advantages to it, because insofar as the sorts of technologies that have originated as a result of the Enlightenment and then the Industrial Revolution can make the lives of others better, that's all for the good. But you can't assume that the liberal principles are going to go hand in hand with the transfer of that technology and the change in power dynamics.
Not to carry on the argument here, but
yeah.
The interesting part of the power replacement is by China.
That's right.
China, which has a state high state intervention policy, an anti-family policy, an anti-marriage policy.
Right.
Which is almost turned your argument on.
The major limitation, though, of China in the future is its growing population. It would be far more robust and far more of a threat than it is if it didn't limit its population, because overall they're going to be facing some of the same challenges that that Western societies are, where you have a disproportionately older population. That is trying to support the civilization or the culture. So it's not entirely clear. On the one hand, economically, they have gained tremendously. They have been able to rely upon the fact that they have a phenomenal population as a basis of power. Couple that with becoming more liberal economically. But they too, eventually, that's going to be a problem for them. It's not entirely clear cut. Now, the ones, I mean, there are some groups that are reproducing, and as I said, when you get lots of reproduction, there's a downside to everything. The downside, of course, to lots of reproduction is that it tends to destabilize your society, because when you get large youth populations, they're very creative. They're, you know, it just tends to, as you can think about, you know, the 60s, that sort of thing. Right now, Islam has been going through a baby boom for over 20 years. So right now, in part, the kind of destabilization that we see is that you have a growing youth population, and you also don't have a firm set of authority in place to kind of guide and gear that. Thank you. Yeah, I think they're telling me to shut up now. and Sub-Saharan Africa, which has its own set of difficulties. Yes, go ahead.
One of the qualifications that John mentioned yesterday was that the state probably, at least at this point, in any foreseeable future, can't revisit these issues, but other aspects of the society and institutions, you know, depending on voluntary decisions and personal convictions that people have. But that also, I say that, but then also, even within the West, you hear, there's been some analysis in the U.S., and I've seen some articles looking at least on a curiosity level in Canada, the whole demographic difference in the U.S. between the so-called red states versus the blue states, the states that voted for Bush versus Kerry, talking about the ideological and philosophical convictions and differences between these two general different groups of people, and therefore, you know, talking about demography is destiny, right? So, I mean, even within the West, these things may come around again.
Well, I wouldn't say it's destiny, but it's tremendously influential. It's not something to be discounted at all. In terms of how it plays out in the United States, you're right that those states that that support President Bush tend to have somewhat higher birth rates and such. But it's also that there is a greater prevalence of religion in these areas, and those who tend to have a third child are those who have strong faith.
And that's my point.
Yeah.
People with that viewpoint, if they get to be a large enough proportion of the demography and the electorate, then, you know, then they could introduce politicians into office that will revisit and re-legislate on these issues. It could be 50, 100, 200 years down the road. Maybe the U.S. and Canada won't exist as nations anymore after that, but I'm just saying that nothing's inevitable.
That's right. And I think that's something that needs to be recognized, is that oftentimes We operate within ideological frameworks. We all need them. Ideology is not necessarily a bad thing. It becomes pernicious, however, when you can't learn from experience. When you're still trying to frame things in the same old terms, and objective reality is telling you it's not working. So to the extent that we have a situation in which we're ready to further dismantle marriage, which is already posing a real challenge to the long-term sustainability of our civilization, I would say we have ideological blinders on in a pernicious sense. Any other questions? Okay.
I'd like to thank Dr. Sidran. He's going to, I know we've had the room for a few minutes extra, and I don't know if there's anybody scheduled after us, but I'd like to thank you, Dr. Sidran, for all your work and your efforts to challenge your black force today. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
We have a little remembrance of us. And so we'd
like so kind.
Let you remember us by taking a small token of our esteem and thanking us to you as well back to Florida.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
So you can remember. No, it's not.
Thank you. Very nice to meet all of you.
I think that I hope you've been challenged and had some thought-provoking thoughts placed in your mind today as well. That was part of our intent is to create an atmosphere of discussion, to create an atmosphere of challenge. Something that will take us forward on this issue, and the IMFC will be doing that again in the future as well.